Penguin Random House Audio presents Leading Men by Christopher Castellani. Read for you by Eduardo Ballerini. To Michael, in return for Italy.
There are some simply extraordinary people in Portofino. The place is rampant with the kind of goings-on Jennifer never really believes go on. There's an Australian girl who ran away with her stepfather, and a Swedish mother and daughter who share a fisherman between them, etc. But these are very ordinary instances. Altogether, the place is fraught with peril.
Truman Capote, in a letter to David O. Selznick, June 23, 1953.
My name for him is Little Horse. I wish he had a name for me.
Tennessee Williams. Collected Poems. Chapter 1. The Little Horse. Truman was throwing a party in Portofino, and Frank wanted to go. The invitation came in mid-July, slipped between parentheses and the long gossipy paragraphs of his letter to Ten, as if daring him to acknowledge it. Frank read the letter in Ten's absence. He'd been stuck for weeks in their stuffy fourth-floor apartment on Via Firenze, waiting for him to get back from Spain, while on the loud streets below, the real Romans escaped for the mountains. He replied to Truman with a brief telegram, and then he called the finest hotel in town, the Splendido, to book a room. He auditioned various linen jackets and swim trunks and hats in the mirror above the dresser, mended two pairs of Ten's socks, and walked their silks down to the cleaners. When Ten returned home to find their bags lined up in the hall, packed for another trip, he didn't protest. He was sweet on Frank again after 3 weeks apart. A drive in the Jag up the coast of Liguria, far from the melting heart of the Centro, could only make things sweeter. They took one last walk through the Villa Borghese. They followed two boys, the dark one, Ten's, the blonde for Frank, down the Spanish steps and out the eastern side to the Corso, pulled along by the smoothness of their elbows. Not a hint of saggy skin on Ten's boy, his long arms tanned by lazy days on the beach at Ostia, or on Frank's, a Swiss. Who could say where the Swiss got that scar, new and pink across the knob of the elbow, or where he spent his own empty afternoons? Who could say he was a Swiss at all, and not from some disappointing place like Minnesota? Who could say the scar didn't come from an iron fence he'd tumbled over, running from a cuckold in Lugano, his wife in the doorway, clutching a robe and pleading for mercy? They could say, Frank and Ten, walking at a safe distance behind the boys, as they liked so very much to do evenings after dinner those summers they lived in Rome, inventing lives for the Italians, inventing lives for themselves. It's what Ten was famous for. It was one of the many happy ways they passed their time together. They brought back the dark one, Mario, to Via Firenze. A Sicilian, like Frank, it turned out, but at least he wasn't American. As he hastily slipped on his espadrilles, color rising in his cheeks, Frank said to him, "You've just slept with one of the world's greatest writers." And because Mario had heard of Tennessee Williams, he stayed for the coffee and pastries Frank brought onto the terrace. Soon Mario grew tiresome, as they all did, talking of his mother, who expected him home, who worried there was always a mother, and they watched with relief as he and his tight elbows descended the stairs. He wasn't the first Mario, of course. Over the years, they forgot their names, but not their scars, or their attitudes, or the stories they told as they lay between them late into the night. Sometimes on their evening walks, the streets sultry and flickering with shadows, they'd spot one of the Marios in a piazza with his pack of friends laughing, his arms slung over a girl's shoulder. If the Mario noticed them, he'd turn his face away or shoot back a look of defiance and shame and fear, which enlarged them. They left Rome like this, big as elephants, the heat and storms behind them, the top down on the Jag, for Portofino. Frank slept most of the way, his head on Ten's lap, and then again on the skiff from Rapallo, though Ten kept nudging him awake to point out the houses on the cliffs.
"You like the orange?" he asked. "The yellow?"
No, that blue up top. I'm shopping, Frankie. Any of these can be ours.
Truman had rented an apartment a few steps from the harbor, above the Delfino restaurant, which Frank and Ten passed on their way up the hill to the Splendido. Ten paid the boat guy to carry their luggage, and when the hill got too steep, Frank grabbed the heavy case with the typewriter. He didn't like it when another guy did work for him that he could do himself, a guy who would have been him if he'd never left Jersey. The Splendido was first a monastero, the boat guy told them. And now look at it. Che spettacolo! The place Clark Gable drinks his brandy to a view. Ten went straight to the desk as usual, and Frank arranged their dress shirts on hangers and brought their shoes down for shining and stole another hour for a nap. He'd never felt so tired in the middle of the afternoon, and he chalked it up to being 30, but it's possible, no doctor was ever able to tell him for sure one way or the other, that the trouble had already started in his lungs. When he woke, Ten offered him a pill. Ten had as many pills as Italy had houses on the water, but Frank wasn't taking pills. Not then. Instead, he smoked another cigarette and paid the boat guy to drive him over the mountain to Paraggi Beach, where he swam to find his strength and clear his head. They didn't like Truman much, but Frank didn't hate him the way Ten did. Or maybe Ten didn't hate Truman. It was hard to know for sure with Ten. It was a job in itself keeping track of who he was angry with and who was jealous of him, whose parties he was looking forward to, and whose they'd have to make up some excuse to get out of. Frank's official job was as Ten's secretary, but even his secretary didn't have a reason for being in Portofino other than to stop by Truman's party, and he didn't know when they'd be leaving. There wasn't much Frank knew in the summer of 1953, least of all how long he and Ten might last. In those years, there was no such thing as early, late, or on time. They went from place to place on a magic carpet, dropped here, dropped there. Women in electric dresses, men in monkey suits and bow ties made of white silk. Cognac, cigars, wine, the sky turquoise even when it was gray. Because Ten had no mind and little use for schedules and logistics and coordinates. He needed Frank to organize the day they woke, and the coming days, and even the days before. The dinner they'd had in London, Ten swore on Mother Edwina's grave they'd had in Chicago. The party for the Sweet Bird of Youth tryout in Philadelphia, he remembered as the one in New Haven for Camino Real. The life of Tennessee Williams was a memory play in which memory was a jumble. It was bodies he remembered. Bodies they remembered together. His body and Frank's, the Southern gentleman, and the little horse. The bodies of all the Marios, from Key West to Marrakesh. When it came to matters of the body, Frank and Ten trusted each other like soldiers. At the Delfino, Frank lost track of him the first minute. Ten couldn't walk into a room without someone sweeping him up and into a crowd. How many times had Frank stood at the edge of the crowd, as if on a shore, watching him drift farther and farther out, his head bobbing on the waves, glancing back just once to meet his eyes? How many times had Frank found himself in an overflowing room like this one? Greeting guests as they arrived, recognizing their faces from movies and the backstages of theaters. How many times had these people walked in, looked around, saw Frank, saw nobody, spotted a somebody over his shoulder, and then headed upstairs? A brass band started up. Frank danced with a French girl whose uncle watched from the bar. Girls liked to dance with Frank, and he with them. He had a way with a spin and a twirl and a catch and a bow. And this French girl, she could follow. That wasn't always the case with girls, even the fancy brought-up girls, but dancing with the clomping ones, the Clydesdales, he called them, even that was better than dancing with a guy, which he and Ten never did anyway, not with each other at least, not even in Provincetown. He saw the world like that a lot then, what he did with Ten, what he'd done with girls. He had his hands all over the Frenchie, Martine, until he noticed the uncle giving him the stink eye. He let her spin into some other man's arms. He brought a whiskey over to the uncle, not bad looking himself once he relaxed and the stink left his eye, and they got to talking. They'd both been at Guadalcanal. They traded stories loud over the music.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?